Ruth chapter 1. And as soon as I say that, some of you are thinking, I thought we were going to be in Judges this week.
You are.
And we are, because there are 39 books in the Old Testament, and we don't have 39 weeks for our Old Testament survey. So we have to double up some books, and this week I've been asked to cover Judges and Ruth. And to be honest, at the start of the week, as I started studying, that was a little bit disappointing. I really didn't want to do that, actually. Judges is a long, complicated book, and it's a serious book, and there's plenty there for a week Sunday school lesson. And Ruth is a wonderful book, and I would love to spend a whole week on the book of Ruth. So I was actually a little bit disappointed, discouraged. Do I really have to do this? And I was worried that you would go away disappointed. I'm not sure we can do both of these books justice in one little Sunday school lesson. Is there a chance you're going to go away disappointed? And this has been a good week for all of us to remind ourselves that God really knows how to work things together for you. And I'm a little bit disappointed that I have more to say about these two books than I can possibly fit in one Sunday school lesson. But there are two very good things that can come out of doing Judges and Ruth at the same time. And that's where I want to start. Instead of the word disappointed, how about if we try the word hungry? If you leave a Sunday school lesson like this, hungry for more, wishing for more, having a sense that there's more in this book that we didn't have time to discover, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. That might help you when you get to Judges in your Bible reading. And what, about July, you're going to get to Judges? And if there's a little bit of a sense in your spirit of, hey, I'm looking forward to this. I want to dive into this book. I realize more than ever there's good stuff in this book that we're not going to get to in one Sunday school lesson. That's the way it is with food, right? The Bible encourages us to compare this to our spiritual food. Do you wake up and say, oh, I got to eat breakfast again? I'll do my duty this morning. I'll eat breakfast. Most of us, when we get up, we're hungry. We want to eat breakfast. That's not a problem. In fact, if one of your kids wakes up and says, Mom, I'm really not hungry today. I really don't feel like eating breakfast. That's probably a sign that something's wrong, right? You're suspicious. That's really the way it's supposed to be in our Christian life. So if we go away from Sunday school, hungry for more Judges, hungry for more Ruth, that would be a good thing. And there's a second good that will come out of this, and we discover it when I ask the question, why combine these two books? Of all the ways we could double up books, why would they pick Judges and Ruth to study together? And you probably know the answer. What's the answer?
They happen at the same time.
They happen at the same time. Look at Ruth 1:1. It came to pass, came about, in the days when the judges governed. These books go together, and God points it out to us. God connects these books. The story of Ruth is set during the time of the judges. And that reminds us that the Old Testament is not just a collection of 39 isolated books. The Old Testament is one big story. And we're reminded of that when we survey, when we go fast, when we compare book to book. When you focus on each individual character, each chapter, each story, sometimes we lose sight of the big story. So looking at Joshua, Judges, and Ruth together gives us a chance to look at the big story. You know, people say the Bible is inspired, and absolutely it is. But people also say that the Bible is good literature. And this is a good example of what they're talking about, because we don't have to figure this out. The Bible gives us these little markers. The Bible gives us these little reading tips. The Bible connects up for us the individual books into one big story. And if you think back to our study through the Pentateuch, we saw that. Genesis ends with this nation stuck in Egypt, and Joseph is in a coffin in Egypt. And Exodus picks up that very story and says, now what about those people in Egypt? Whatever happened to them? And you come all the way forward to Joshua last week, and Joshua ends with Joseph's bones brought up out of Egypt, buried in the promised land. And what I'm saying is, when God writes that at the end of the book of Joshua, he's connecting the dots for us. He's reminding us that Joshua is a big story that started all the way back in Genesis. And God is reminding us here that Ruth is part of a big story that's rooted in the Judges. And what's really interesting to me is Ruth is connected up to what comes before it, and Ruth is also connected up to what comes after it. There are these little chains, these little threads. And I want to show you. Go to the very end of the book of Ruth. Look at how this book is connected on both ends. You know how this book ends. Verse 21, to Solomon was born Boaz, to Boaz Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse, David. It's not until the last word of the book that we find out. This whole book is actually the backstory to the life of David. How important is David, right? This is the man after God's own heart. This is the king that's like a type of the coming Messiah. This is the greatest days of the nation are ahead, and here are those seeds. And that's really helpful because Judges is a really dark time. We're going to talk about that. When you connect this up to the time of the Judges, you ought to be thinking, oh, that's bad. That was a really dark time. That was a really hard time in Israel's history. Yeah, but look at the chain forward. What's coming is King David. So Ruth is connected to the big story of the Bible, and that's helpful to remind ourselves of. So let's go back to Judges chapter 1. I actually want to spend more of my time in Ruth. But let's look at something from the start of the book of Judges. And let's look at how the book of Judges ends. That will really get us a flavor of the book of Judges. And that will set us up for the story of Ruth. So, Judges chapter 1, verse 1. Like all of these books in the Old Testament, we immediately get a subject. We get a theme. We get the big story of what's going on. The sons of Israel required of the Lord, saying, "Who shall go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" And when you read that, I think we're supposed to stop and say, wait a minute, wasn't that Joshua? Joshua was the conquest. Joshua was fighting the Canaanites. Joshua was taking over the land. So we are being clued that the conquest is actually not over yet. And we saw last week, remember Joshua 18? They conquered five tribes and they were ready to quit. They were going to meet in Shiloh. They were going to wrap this thing up. They were going to get settled. And Joshua had to say to them, look, the job is not done. We've got more work to do. We've got more to conquest. We've got tribes that aren't settled yet. They wanted to quit early. They're still not done. And there's a great parallel here with the Christian life. Because in a moment, you are saved. In a moment, you are sanctified. In a moment, you are justified. And that starts a process. That's going to go on for the rest of your life, as you struggle to conquer everything that needs to be conquered. So, Judges is a story of continued conquest. And this is a great place to raise the question that some skeptics ask. When you read the conquest, when you read Joshua and Judges, it comes across very negatively to a modern reader. It sounds like what we call genocide. Here we are wiping out entire people groups, men and women and children and even animals. There's a lot of killing going on. There's a lot of very negative stuff going on. And people say, what kind of God is this? What kind of religion is this? What's going on that we're advocating genocide? And that's a hard question. There's not a simple one-sentence answer to that question. It starts all the way back in Genesis when God creates the world. And he asserts that I can intervene in this world if I want to because I'm the creator of this world. And it's rooted in the justice of God because he explains why he is judging these people. There's justice at issue here. But still, it's hard to understand. There's something in us that's sympathetic, that struggles to understand why killing all the children is necessary, why genocide is really what's being called for here. And this isn't a complete answer, but there's something that happens in Judges 1 that's very helpful for me. It's not the whole answer, but it's a piece of the puzzle that kind of grounds me in, this is really okay, and God really does know what he's doing here. And it's the story in verse 5 of Adonai Bezek. Because as they conquered the Canaanites, they find this guy, Adonai Bezek, in Bezek, and they fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And Adonai Bezek fled, and they pursued him, and they caught him, and then they did this. They cut off his thumbs and his big toes. And a modern reader reads that and says, this is what we call cruel and unusual punishment. Why are they doing that? Why do they have to do that? Okay, you defeated him, you killed him, you lost the battle, you captured him, whatever. What in the world is the point of this cutting off his big fingers and his big toes? Why such cruel and unusual punishment? And I bring us here because he's going to tell you in his own words. Because in verse 7, Adonai Bezek speaks, and he says to us, to help us understand this situation, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off, used to gather up scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. Why did they do this to Adonai Bezek? Because he was famous for doing this to other people, and they felt like this was an appropriate and just punishment. And what's interesting is the victim agrees. Adonai Bezek has to admit, this is what I've been going around doing to all of my conquests, and it is appropriate. It is a justice, right? God has repaid me what I have done to other people. Right? So we get to hear it not from the mouth of God, not from the mouth of some apologist. We get to hear it from Adonai Bezek himself. He admits, this is what I deserve. So don't say that God is being unjust here. God is doing something cruel and unusual here. God is meting out justice. That always helps me understand. That doesn't explain everything, but that's a piece of what's going on in the conquest. It also is helpful to remember that this is not a holy war. This is not a war against all unbelievers. They were not on a mission to wipe out everybody in the world that didn't worship Jehovah. It might be helpful to go back and look at that, because this actually sets us up for what's going on in Ruth. Would you go back with me to Deuteronomy 20? We're still pursuing this question. How can it be right for them to wipe out these people groups? How can they be doing this? In Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 10, we have this. When you approach a city to fight against it, you shall offer it terms of peace. That's another piece of this puzzle. They were not told to just indiscriminately kill everybody. There were cities that they were told, make an offer of peace. You can make a peace treaty with these people. You can settle peacefully with these people. But verse 15, thus you shall do to all the cities that are far from you, which are not of the cities of the nations nearby. Only in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything. There's a narrow boundary to the people they were supposed to kill. It was just the people in the promised land. All of the other pagan neighbors, they were supposed to try to make peace with them. And that helps me understand. And God's going to explain why now, why there was a difference, why it was so important to treat the people in the promised land this way. Verse 17, you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite. Verse 18, here's why. So that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things. You would sin against the Lord your God. You can handle pagan neighbors who worship other gods, and you can even make peace treaties with them. In a sense, you can get along with them. But we cannot tolerate this in the nation. We can't intermarry with these pagan people. They can't be part of the nation, or they will tear the nation apart. And that's exactly what happened. And I think that's a spiritual picture of what Paul is trying to say in 1 Corinthians 5. If we could connect to something that's very relevant to us, this whole thing about the Canaanite conquest might seem distant and irrelevant to us. But look with me at 1 Corinthians 5. We have a passage here that has been super helpful for me in a lot of situations, over and over again. 1 Corinthians 5, going to start reading in verse 9. I wrote you in a letter not to associate with immoral people. But I did not at all mean with the immoral people of this world, or with the covetous, or swindlers, or with idolaters. If you would try to do that, you would have to go out of the world. Association is a big issue. Association is the middle of a whole lot of fights going on in the church right now. And here, Paul is talking about association. He said, I told you not to associate with immoral people. But I didn't mean you have to go live in a cave as a monk somewhere. That's not what I'm talking about when I said that. What did I mean? Verse 11, I actually wrote to you not to associate with a so-called brother if he is immoral. It's one thing if your neighbor that you live by in the city of Greenville is immoral. It's another thing if the person you're sitting next to at church is immoral. Paul is saying there's a big difference here. We can't go on a crusade to rid the world of immorality. You can't disassociate with everybody in Greenville who happens to be immoral. You would have to leave the world. You would have to live like a monk to do that. How are you going to have any kind of ministry if you do that? But Paul is saying you absolutely cannot tolerate that inside the church. Inside the church, that will ruin the church. And I think that's a parallel to what we're seeing back in Deuteronomy. You can have pagan people around you, and you can live with that, and you can even be at peace with them. But this cannot be tolerated inside the nation. So that's maybe some help. When the question comes up, how can you justify killing all these pagan people? My mind goes to Judges chapter 1. Listen to the testimony of Adonai Bezek. It's not the whole answer, but it will help you. All right, so that's how the book of Judges starts. Let's look at how the book of Judges ends. Judges chapter 21 and verse 25. Many of you know this verse by heart. In those days, what was it like? Well, there was no king in Israel. There were judges, but they were not kings. They were tribal, they were local, they had limited power, they were not kings. There was no king in Israel. Instead, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, don't stumble over the word everyone. Was it literally everyone who did what was right in his own eyes? Well, actually, no. That's the whole point of the book of Ruth. It seemed like the country had gone to pieces and everyone was doing wrong. But down in the little village of Bethlehem, there is a group of faithful people who are trying to do what was right. It is not everyone. Does it bother you that the Bible used the word everyone here? But maybe I should comment about that a little bit. How can the Bible say everyone when it's not actually everyone? And I need to say two things about that. We use that word, and we don't mean literally everyone, and that's okay. This is just language. I could say, it's not going to snow in August, and everyone knows that. The new Frederick Baby doesn't actually know that. But we all understand that there are exceptions when we say things like that, right? This is just language at work. It doesn't bother me that he would say everyone. And what he means is nearly everyone, almost everyone. It seemed like everybody was doing this. But I dug into this a little bit because I was curious. And it's really interesting. In the Hebrew, the word here is not everyone. The word here is the word ish. It's just the word man. This is the common Old Testament word for the word man. And when it's about one person, it means a man, like Adam was a man-ish. But like we use the word man, mankind, the Bible uses the word man to mean people in general, to mean mankind. And that's what it means here. You could substitute the word mankind. You could substitute the word people. If this helps you understand the verse, there was no king. People were doing what was right in their own eyes. Almost everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. That's literally how it reads in Hebrew. People were doing what seemed right in their own eyes. Now, so what's so bad about that? I mean, that's actually pretty popular in our culture. Follow your heart. Do what seems right to you. Be true to yourself. You ought to do what's good in your own eyes, a lot of our culture would say. What in the world would be wrong with that? That's what the end of the book of Judges is there for. Because the last third of the book of Judges is three extended stories that paint a picture of what it gets like when everyone does what's right in their own eyes. And this is very helpful for us because we live in a culture that's going very much in that direction. And you want to know the end of that story? The end of the book of Judges is the end of that story. Could I just summarize for you? We don't have time to do these stories in depth, and I don't want to, because these are shocking stories. These are sordid stories. These are unbelievable stories, and there are three of them. The first of them is Samson, and you know the story of Samson well, right? Samson is a very mixed up man, and he has the Spirit of God on him, and God uses him in a remarkable way, but boy, what a mess of a story. What a mess of a life. What a tragedy the story of Samson is, right? That is a tragic story. That's Samson. And then there's this Ephraimite named Micah, and he makes a silver idol, and he sets up his own temple. And he wants a priest, so he finds this itinerant Levite, and he hires him to be his priest. And the Levite says, sure, I'll come serve in your little homemade temple. I'll help you worship your little silver idol. I will do this. And Micah says, this ought to just boggle your mind. Now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite for a priest. Now, I know how the Ten Commandments start. Don't have any other gods. Don't make any graven images. Well, I've just violated that. But hey, I got a Levite. I got a Levite for a priest, so this is going to work. I'm good. And then the Danites are looking for more territory, and they say there's some nice territory down in Ephraim. So they go down, and they find a nice little peaceful city that's not well defended, and they say, we want that. So they wipe it out, and they take over one of the cities of Ephraim. There's a lot of inter-tribal warfare in the book of Judges. That's actually one of the themes. There's a lot of inter-tribal trouble. So the Danites go down, and they take over this town from the Ephraimites, and Micah is nearby. And they say, hey, instead of being just a priest in your own little town, why don't you come be a priest for a whole tribe? And Micah says, sure, that sounds good. So the tribe of Dan now has their own idol and their own priesthood and their own little temple, and they're setting up their own religion. What a mess. And then there is this story which I don't even want to tell. This man from Benjamin has a fiance from Bethlehem. And they're on a trip, and they get stuck in this out-of-the-way place. And there is this horrible story of homosexuality and gang rape. I mean, that's what it is, to be blunt. It is really, seriously messed up. And this girl was raped until she dies, and her fiancé cuts her body in pieces and sends it all over the country and starts a civil war. I mean, can you imagine a country more messed up? God is trying to paint for us a picture of a society gone astray. And this is the kind of things that are going on. So there is a civil war, and the other 11 tribes attack Benjamin and nearly wipe the entire tribe out. and there are only 600 Benjamites left. And then the rest of the country is really sad over, guess what? We're a 12-tribe nation, and we don't want to go down to 11. Of all the things you might be upset about, this is what they're upset about. We don't actually want to lose a tribe. We don't want to go down to a 11-tribe nation. We need to keep alive somehow our 12th tribe. But there's a problem, because there are only 600 Benjamites left. And in the middle of this civil war, they made a promise. They made a vow to God that nobody will give their daughters to Benjamin to be wives. They're so upset at what the Benjamites have done. They make this solemn vow before God. And now this tribe is about to disappear, and it's their own fault. So what are you going to do about that? Now, if you just thought about all of the ways you might fix that problem, there are lots of solutions. But the solution they come up with is absolutely crazy. And if you read the story, you're just supposed to be shocked. What are these people thinking? What are these people doing? How can this culture be so mixed up? That's what happens when everybody goes their own way. Here's the plan they come up with. When we started the Civil War, did anybody not participate? So they take a little survey, and there's this town, Jabesh-Gilead. Nobody from Jabesh-Gilead joined the Civil War. So let's go kill everybody in Jabesh-Gilead except the young virgins, and we'll give them to be wives to the Benjamites. So they do that. They wipe out an entire town of Israelites, everybody except the young marriage-age girls, and they kidnap them, and they give them to the Benjamites. Here you go. Now you have wives. We don't have to break our vow. Isn't this crazy that they're pretending to be religious? We made this vow to God. We can't break our vow to God. So we'll go wipe out a whole town of people and kidnap all these virgins. That's better than breaking your vow to God somehow. They're just not thinking right. And it comes up 200 short. They only got 400 ladies out of that. We still have 200 Benjamites that don't have wives. Now what are we going to do? Well, nobody can dare violate their vow and give a daughter to Benjamin. We need another plan. So, Shiloh is where the tabernacle is. Shiloh is where we gather at this time in history for national festivals. There's a big national festival coming up. There's going to be partying and dancing and celebration. You 200 Benjamites that need wives, you come to the big party, pick out a girl that you like, kidnap her, and take her home. Does that sound like a great plan? I mean, what are these people thinking? What is going on here? These are people who have lost all ability to reason. Are you still in Judges 21? Look at verse 22. Well, look at verse 21. If the daughters of Shiloh come out and take part in the dances, catch one. Just take one and kidnap her and take her home. And you know what's going to happen, verse 22? Their fathers or their brothers are going to complain. I guess so. You kidnap my daughter, you kidnap my sister. Their fathers, their brothers are going to complain. We say to them, no, you give up your daughter voluntarily. Because we didn't take enough for the men in battle. And you can't give them to them, you would be guilty of breaking your vow. You're stuck. You have no choice. You can't break your vow. You can't give her away. Our plan to steal wives, we didn't get enough. So this is the only choice. You've got to give up your daughter. Can you imagine? This is a picture of a society in total moral chaos. I heard a story this week that I think is a modern illustration of people whose thinking is just completely messed up. There's a school called Wellesley College. Have you heard of this? It is the nation's top women's college, I'm told. Hillary Clinton went there, among other famous people. And it's a women's college. It's been that way since 1870. But it will not shock you at all that in 2015 they voted to allow men who identify as women to attend, right? Because men who identify as women are women from their point of view. That's not really the surprising thing. That's not really the shocking thing. What happened this week at Wellesley is the student body took a poll. The student body passed a referendum. the student body recommended to the school that they stop discriminating against women who identify as men and let them come too. We already let men who think they're women come. What about the women who think they're men? Now we're discriminating against them. We should let them come to our women's college too. I'm having troubles even following them. The logic there is escaping me. And that's the point. This is what happens when there's no king and there's no respect for God's law and everyone does what seems right in their own eyes. At that very dark hour, God is already setting the stage for what comes next. The nation seems to be falling apart, but the greatest years for the kingdom are still ahead. In this quiet little village of Bethlehem, there are some faithful people who are still following God. Do you remember Elijah? 1 Kings 19, he's discouraged, he's running, he's complaining to God. 1 Kings 19:14, I have been very zealous for the Lord. The sons of Israel have abandoned your covenant. They killed your prophets. I alone am left. And God said, no. There are several thousand people in this country who have not bowed to Baal. Take encouragement that you are not the only one. There have always been, there always will be, there is in America today a remnant, probably thousands of people who have not bowed the knee, who are not confused, who are not going their own way. That is true then, that is true now. And there's a wonderful picture here of what's going on in Bethlehem. I noticed as I read through Judges, Bethlehem shows up two or three times. The stray Levite priest who goes to serve the silver god, he was actually from Bethlehem. The fiance who gets murdered, she was actually from Bethlehem. Judges weaves Bethlehem into that story, and it's not necessarily good. But when you get to Ruth, you find out it's not just Ruth. It's not just Boaz. We are painted a picture of a little community that's really trying to do right. I mean, here is Boaz. He's called a man of noble character. And if you just want a little snapshot of what life is like in Bethlehem, should we go back to Ruth now? Look at Ruth 2:4. Boaz came from Bethlehem. He goes out to the fields. It's harvest time. And this rich landowner walks out in the fields and he greets the workers and he says, may the Lord be with you. And they say back to him, may the Lord bless you. That's just a little vignette, a little snapshot of a culture where God is the center of everyday life. And when the boss shows up in the fields, this is the interaction. In the headlines this week was Starbucks union busting, tension between the boss and the workers and all of that. That's always been part of life, right? And especially when people are going their own way, not in Bethlehem. There's apparently a great relationship, a godly relationship, a mutual respect. The book is full of these little clues, these little hints that this is what's like in Bethlehem. Let me show you Ruth 4:11. This is how the townspeople talk after Boaz makes the deal for Ruth. Ruth 4:11. All the people who were in the court and the elders, this is probably just the men, said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. May you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Phares, who Tamar bore to Judah. That's how talk goes. If you just drop in the marketplace and the men are standing around talking, and this big legal transaction just took place, and this is what the men of the town are standing around talking about. This is the advice they have to share with Boaz. I'm saying that's a little window into the character of the town. It's a little window into the way the men talk. How about the ladies? We've got to turn pages here. Look at verse 4:14. Chapter 4, verse 14. The men of the town are huddled around Boaz and the legal deal he just did. The women of the town are huddled around Naomi here. And what are they talking about? Blessed is the Lord, who has not left you without a redeemer today. May his name become famous in Israel. May he be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer in your old age. Your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. Do you hear the townspeople talk? Boaz is a great guy. He's a God-fearing, kind, compassionate, tender man. Ruth is an amazing girl. She's loyal, she's compassionate, she's polite, she's bold. And the townspeople. It seems to be the culture of this town that they are honoring God. Is it any wonder that the man after God's own heart is going to come from here? Is it any wonder that this is where David grows up? Because God is establishing a community here, a culture here, a background, a heritage. This is David's spiritual heritage. I think that's why the book ends the way it does. I just explained to you the spiritual heritage of this great man, David. So I say to the moms, to the teachers, to the nursery workers, maybe God hasn't called you to do great exploits like David. Maybe he's calling you to build a community, a culture that will nourish the next King David. That's Ruth's part of the story. That's Naomi's part of the story. That's these farm hands. That's Boaz. Boaz is not going to be the great king of Israel that's going to lead them on mighty conquests. Boaz is part of a little community, a little culture in which King David can appear. All right, now, interesting question. Is the Book of Ruth a romance? J. Vernon McGee wrote a commentary on the Book of Ruth, and he called it Ruth, the Romance of Redemption. Many people refer to this as a wonderful story of romance. But there are other commentators who say no. One commentator said, this is a story of love, but it's not a story of romance. He points to the word hesed, that loving kindness that's so central to the Old Testament. That's the word that appears three times. It's interesting that Ruth is said to show hesed to her deceased husband. Naomi said, you are a good daughter-in-law. You showed hesed to my son. It's used of Ruth to Naomi. Ruth showed loving kindness to her mother-in-law, Naomi. It's the prayer that God will show loving kindness to Ruth. There's not actually a whole lot of romance in the book. This is not Ruth finds her Prince Charming. This is not Ruth sees this attractive young man out in the fields and says, I want to marry him. I think if I read the story right, this is actually an arranged marriage, right? Naomi told Ruth, you're going to marry Boaz. You go do this. We don't live in a culture where people arrange marriages, but this was a culture where marriages are arranged. There's a sense in which this is a arranged marriage. And that's what leads people to say, well, technically it's not a romance. There's love in this book, but there's not romance. So I want to ask you, what do you think? Is this just a story of love? Is this a story of romance? What do you think?
God's will.
It's what?
God's will.
It's certainly God's will, right? This one of the themes of the Book of Ruth is providence. There's this famous phrase, she just happened to end up in the field of Boaz. And the wise reader says, yeah, right, I know what that means. She just happened to end up in the field of Boaz in the obvious providence of God. This was the man for Ruth, right? There's no doubt about that. These two were supposed to get married in the providence of God. But it's not because Ruth saw him across a crowded room and said, that's the man for me. Right? I'm just asking what you think. Says that the providence of God at work here. Absolutely. We're going to come back to that. Anybody else have any thoughts? I'm just curious, partly. We're almost out of time.
That's how my second marriage got started.
We could have an interesting testimony time. Apparently, Boaz is significantly older than Ruth. I thought we could get Esther's take on that.
The head and the heart right, everything else can work accurately.
Everything else works out okay. Yeah, I'm pretty confident that Boaz and Ruth fall in love eventually.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not what's happening in the first day in the field. And I've been thinking about how often that happened in arranged marriages. I've been trying to put myself in the shoes of people who grow up in a culture where you're not going to choose your partner. Your parents are going to choose for you. You're going to be put in an arranged marriage. How difficult it probably is to trust God in that situation. When you have no control and you're not making a choice and you can't make a choice and you just have to believe that your parents, who you probably fully know are flawed, right? Kids are well aware that their parents are not perfect. I'm going to trust God that somehow I'm going to end up with the partner that is God's choice for me, that is appropriate for me, someone that I can hopefully fall in love with and spend my life with. What a great example of the necessity to walk by faith.
We have a couple up at First Baptist Troy, Indian background. Mom and Dad got the daughter and two suitors together and let her choose. Mm. She had 2 hours of confrontation or discussion with the two.
And then she had to choose.
One.
Wow.
They've been married ever since. Very good for a couple.
Now, here's how I want to apply that. If I could leave you something to take home and think about. Nobody in this room, I don't think, is in that situation. Nobody in this room is facing an impending arranged marriage and having to trust God with what's coming in my future. But nearly everybody in this room is facing some uncertainty about the future in some way. There's probably something going on in your life. There's something in your personal future that you're not sure how it's going to work out. That you are maybe not actually in control of. And you have to live by faith. You have to trust God. You have to say, I know God's in control. I know the providence of God is behind this. This is not just happenstance. God will make this work together for good. I grew up thinking the just are saved by faith, and that's not what it says. It says the just shall live by faith. Ruth and Boaz are a story of a community that truly lives by faith. And Ruth tells us that even in the middle of the darkest times, you can do that. Let's pray.
Amen.
Father, thank you for these stories. Thank you for this insight into what's happening in a very dark time in Israel's history. Help us to be like Boaz. Help us to be like Ruth. Help us to walk by faith. In Jesus' name, amen.